think a lot of people were surprised that Kim was treated, you know, almost as a rock star by everybody, and that he was normalized in a way.
And I'm there in the green room talking with the producer, and all of the CNN production staff is still a bit rattled because he did start crying. It was a very emotional moment for him. And it was great television. I wouldn't draw any foreign policy conclusions from it, but as a television moment, it's something that goes viral.
I'm Steve Stein, and this is Inside Asia. In this episode, we're looking back at the Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump meetup in Singapore. 3 weeks feels like the distant past, and that's the point. This news cycle is more like a news cyclone. There was much ado about the meeting of the two corpulent men, but now that the dust has settled, what do we have to show for it? To get perspective, we reached out to two key members of the Inside Asian Network, both of whom have a deep knowledge of the region and who also happen to have been on the ground in Singapore. First up is Steve Okun. He's senior advisor at McClarty Associates and for the last 12 years has served as governor of the Singapore Chamber of Commerce. He's a trusted source who happened to also have a ringside seat at the festivities. Was this one of those surrealistic moments that defied logic and protocol, or was it the first small step toward the giant leap of opening North Korea? And what was it like in Singapore when the circus arrived?
In a way, most people, almost everybody here, was not involved or a part of it at all, because unlike, you know, most major events where you might have conferences that are set up around them, or you might have receptions that are set up around them. One, this came up relatively fast because it was, you know, on, off. So there was really no planning for it, no ability to plan anything for it. Nobody knew how difficult it would be in terms of security to move around, you know, so we had thought, well, should we do, you know, a panel or something at AmCham? But we were, you know, the AmCham office were in the secure zone, so we didn't think we could plan it because we didn't know if people were going to be able to get in or out. Turns out they could have very easily. The security was very tight, but very, very well done. So almost no one felt like it was here. You were watching it on TV, or you might see a road closure sign. And
yeah.
That was about it. And was, you know, I was lucky enough, you know, to obviously be involved through the media. So I was, you know, part of that excitement and energy and could feel it. But it was only when I was doing that. And where it hit home to me was there was, you know, the summit ended on Tuesday. And on Wednesday, there's this club, you know, the 1880 Club, had a salon where we're brought in some speakers just to talk about what happened in reaction. And normally, you know, you might get 30 people go to these. A big one, you might get 50. There were 270 people.
No kidding. Everybody who was there and didn't know what was happening, so they came to 1880 to hear what others might have heard. Is that the idea?
Well, I think it was because everybody was asking, oh, what's it like, what's it like, what's it like? And for most people, they couldn't say, well, this is what it's like. So this gave an opportunity to have the community come together here, you know, to hear from a Washington Post reporter who was, you know, here for covering it. And then it gave people a sense that they actually were part of it. Because it's very difficult to feel like you were part of it here. It was so last minute and so isolated.
Yeah, and also it's on Sentosa. And for, you know, listeners, people who may not know about Sentosa, is this tiny little island that sits just a spit away from Singapore proper. And I think in the day, you know, people used to quip and they set up theme parks and they've got a casino and it's kind of like nice little beaches and a couple hotels. In the day, they called it Disneyland with a death penalty, I think. But I think we've moved on from that. And now it's just kind of a quaint little resort center. Did they just lock down the bridge or could you come and go? I mean, to the best of your knowledge, people who were living over there, did they encounter any delays or issues?
Again, I mean, it was narrowed off so you could get on and off. Now, I think for those few hours when they were actually both on Sentosa, you know, different story. But I mean, I have friends who live on Sentosa, have mutual friends on Sentosa, and they would, you know, go for their walks and they would see the security. I mean, the security was very present. They could see it. But no problems. Really, just living their normal lives. And even, you know, I drove the kids by the St. Regis when Kim was there, and you know, they had two lanes blocked off, but otherwise you could go down, you know, what was Tanglin Road on the way to Orchard Road, but
right.
No problem.
Very interesting.
Really, very, very well done. No surprise by Singapore.
Oh, okay.
I would say, I think I will get, and maybe this could get a little bit into your first question. I think a lot of people were surprised that Kim was treated, you know, almost as a rock star.
Yeah.
And by everybody, not by Jim, not by, you know, and that he was normalized in a way. And I think people question whether everybody went overboard, that this is a, you know, one of the worst human rights violators in the world. Obviously he's a leader and he's somebody you need to deal with, and you know, the denuclearization of the peninsula, if we can get there, is incredibly important. But did we all go too far, you know, with the selfies and you know, playing, oh, he's going to, you know, Gardens by the Bay, oh, he's going to Marina Bay Sands, which I think, you know, pictures. And I think that was, you know, there was that element of a circus a bit around here that people were a little bit surprised by.
Steve, how do you account for that? It's like, you know, a debutante ball. I mean, it's his coming out party. Is it just the fact that he left North Korea and he's showing his face and he's actually real, not some caricature of a dictator that got people's attention? Because it is an odd reaction if you think about it.
No, it is an odd reaction. And I think that could play into this normalizing of him is something that he very much wanted. And, you know, you saw the, I don't know if you saw the Economist had a cover story. It said, you know, Kim Jong-un, you know, W-O-N.
Right.
And he won on the PR side. And now he's, you know, meeting with everybody, right. With, you know, Xi and Putin and Trump and everyone else. I think that is going to make the keeping the, you know, sanctions on much more difficult, and that is going to then make the negotiations on the commitments to denuclearization and all of the verification that's going to need to go into that much harder to enforce.
So if Trump did one thing, he legitimized Kim on the international stage. So now that he's met the U.S. president, everybody seems to think, well, that's the green flag. You know, no harm, right? You know, it's not like we are the first and we've broken some code. We can all step in and have our own set of discussions. So to that end, I mean, even though there was no diplomatic protocol or practices or footwork or legwork behind this, in that very gesture, might have Trump averted a global crisis or a nuclear war? What would you think?
Well, I mean, that is what we're, you know, you said at the front, you know, give it, you know, 5 days or so and then do your story. I think we're going to have to give this, I mean, months, if not years, to figure out if Trump actually is going to, you know, accomplish the goal, which is not only to avert nuclear war, but to you know, eliminate that possibility on the Korean, you know, peninsula. And I said going into the negotiations that Donald Trump has no track record whatsoever of creating an international agreement. He has a track record of destroying or withdrawing from international agreements, you know, be it the TPP, be it Iran, be it Paris, maybe with NAFTA, we'll, you know, that we'll have to see if that gets destroyed. But he has no track record of having created one, and he hasn't created any new agreements. Certainly the signing, the declaration that was signed here in Singapore was not binding. It was just a reaffirmation of what North Korea had said they were going to do even just 2 weeks earlier. The jury is way out on this one.
Okay.
And I'm still pessimistic that it's going to come back with a Nobel Prize for the president.
This is Inside Asia, and this episode, we're looking back at Trump's Singapore summit with Kim Jong-un. That was Steve Okun, a former president of the Singapore Chamber of Commerce and senior advisor at McClarty Associates. When we come back, I speak with Frank Lavin, founder and chairman of Export Now and a former U.S. ambassador to Singapore. Stay with us. I'm Steve Stein, and this is Inside Asia. Let's turn now to Frank Lavin, founder and chairman of Export Now and a former U.S. ambassador to Singapore. Frank is based in Singapore and, as you might expect, found himself pulled in by CNN and others to comment. I put the same question to him that I put to Steve Okun. Is the Trump-Kim meeting to be seen as a window of opportunity or further evidence that we're living in the matrix where perception and reality have parted ways? And again, what was it like on the ground?
Well, it captivated the town. It captivates the region. And one of my words of caution is be careful about being caught up in the enthusiasm.
Right.
That typically regimes change slowly, if at all. The regimes are less prone to change if they're still part of the founding family. So they have all sorts of incentives to remain where they are. They have all sorts of sort of psychological or stature losses if they do change. So it's hard for them to change. But they might. You never know. I mean, at some point, you know, the people do want to move toward maybe a more open political system or a benign political system. So that kind of evolution can take place. And I think you've always got to be hopeful about it, always be willing to engage with the dictator in that. But I would say take it step by step and look for proof on the other side that they actually are making those changes.
Well, what proof is there, I guess, is the question, right? I mean, anything substantial other than lip service? I will give up my nuclear weapons. I mean, you know, he's alluded to the possibility, but when, how, where, what order, no details. I mean, there really hasn't been a single gesture of substance, has there?
No, there's been some gestures. They did destroy one site. They have stopped. There's been no tests of either ballistic missiles or nuclear weapons this year, so they have ceased. But what is hard to say, you know, sort of proving a negative. How do you prove or establish that the nuclear capability, the ballistic missile capability, is 100% destroyed? I mean, who has that kind of comprehensive, you know, ability to monitor all of North Korea? So even as they let inspectors in or they have declared nuclear sites, so you can prove the positive. You can say you declared these six testing sites and we've evaluated all six of them and all six of them are now defunct, but that sure doesn't prove that for the whole country they're gone. So it's very difficult to monitor. This, by the way, backs into the Iran set of issues too,
yeah.
Where Iran said up front, we will declare sites for you to inspect, but any military site is off limits to start with.
Right.
So you're never
right.
going to be able to prove we're complying. So the administration said, well, look, we don't like that agreement. We're pulling out of that agreement. So, you have to, I think, move very skeptically with dictatorships as to whether they're going to honor these agreements or not.
Well, you know, it's kind of this bizarre, you know, two-sided coin where, and the coin's name is legitimacy, where on the one hand, you know, he's legitimized Kim by meeting him, and now every other ruler of any other country says, well, you know, if Kim shows up, no harm in having conversations. It's not like I was the first to step through that threshold. And the other side of that legitimacy is he's legitimized the fact that we can talk and should talk to anybody, no matter what type of despot they are and how many atrocities, you know, they perpetrated. So it's a strange, it's a completely, I don't know if there's another example in the world quite like it or in history. I mean, have you ever seen or can you recall anything that's happened like this in, you know, modern history where somebody has just decided because he or she can, they walk through and do something like this?
It's a little bit unusual, and again, I think it's probably most similar to Obama and Cuba, where he's conferred enormous legitimacy to them, and you know, sort of not quite embraced them, but sort of taking them on the path to say we want to welcome you into the family of nations. It is a little unusual because, to my mind, Cuba had done nothing to demonstrate good faith or goodwill that it wanted to release political prisoners or wanted to allow freedom of speech or internet connectivity. And North Korea has not particularly done anything either that you'd sort of say, we do welcome you. We do always want to help you reach out the hand of friendship, but really the first steps ought to be from your end. And it is unusual. It is unusual to see these kind of steps being taken.
Yeah, I mean, Cuba's an interesting one, and I'm glad you raised that because, you know, but yet they're different thicknesses of veil. I mean, the veil on North Korea is about as thick and dark as it gets. And at least Cuba, there's been, you know, bilateral or multilateral discussions, travel, tourism, openness, arts. There's been more of a recognition that it feels like maybe enough time has passed. But you're right. I mean, if it given, you know, I can't think of another example out there, right?
Well, but I would say, but I think your demarcation is fair, but I would say Cuba today probably performs more or less like Eastern Europe under the Soviet regime, where you certainly could have tourists to Czechoslovakia, you certainly have the Czech Film Festival, you certainly have an exchange of somebody or academics or something. But and so there's elements of openness, so to speak, but it's still a Soviet society, it's still a one-party dictatorship. There's still no human rights in that society, but you're right. There's at least more familiarity there than a place like North Korea, where North Korea is almost like China 1970 or something. I mean, yeah. It's just a very repressive Stalinist regime, so it's not as open, so to speak, as even the Soviet Union was. But I would tell anybody, be very careful about opening up to the Soviet Union. Be very careful about opening up to Cuba, and it's really up to the Cuban government to make the first moves. And if anything, I mean, my big fear is there's nothing wrong with U.S. trying, there's nothing wrong with some outreach attempts. The big problem, as you point out, when you confirm legitimacy, everything I've seen tells me that Cuba is playing a stepped-up role in supporting repression in Venezuela since we've engaged. So what is our engagement?
Interesting.
Conferred legitimacy, and it's made things worse. And this exact same scenario might play out in North Korea, that you confer legitimacy, you reward them, and things get worse. And again, it might play out in Iran, that we've helped them in some respects, but they might take all of that help to accelerate the nuclear weapons program. So be very careful about dealing with these guys.
Well, Frank, you know, as a former diplomat and former U.S. ambassador to Singapore, I mean, the devil is in the details, isn't it? And we've got to get down now to the nitty gritty. And I guess just whether it's Cuba or any other country, or particularly North Korea, now, you know, in theory, you would have, I mean, after a very public occasion like this, you would typically have working groups who would step in and start working through some of the kind of nuances of some of the loose agreements that were made. But is there any indication from your reading or from your discussions that that's happening now?
Yeah, first, you're exactly right. But now they've had sort of a symbolic moment where, you know, the interaction and the exchanges and even the statements are sort of promising, but there's no architecture behind it. Now they have to put together the architecture. I would say, in fairness to both sides, this could easily take 90 days or so to have working groups show up in North Korea or to come up with an inspection protocol or a timetable. But I would say for the U.S., it behooves the U.S. to front-load all of that, to say we need to see in the next 90 days these four steps being taken as signs of good faith. So we need to see declared nuclear sites, declared test laboratories, declared ballistic missile facilities, and so forth. And we need to see that list. And we're going to second a group of inspectors, monitors, to review these sites and have these discussions. So I think that protocol has to start right away. I'd look beyond your comment, Steve, as to what kind of architecture working groups. I'd also look for, if you will, independent verification. By independent verification in this context, I mean, what is Kim Jong-un telling his own people? What are the daily newspapers in North Korea saying? If they are relating the truth as the U.S. sees it, that's a very positive sign. If they are saying that North Korea is part of this peace deal, North Korea is dismantling its nuclear weapons program, and they're telling the entire country that's a statement of independent assertion that they are committed to going down that path. But if they're by the same token, if all of this is just goodwill and photographs and a new era of peace, and there's no actually specific statement about the nuclear weapons program, then I say that's a cause for concern from our part.
This is Steve Stein, and you're listening to Inside Asia. My guests this episode have been Frank Lavin, former ambassador to Singapore and now founder and chairman of Export Now, and earlier in the program, Steve Okun, a former and longtime chairman of the Singapore Chamber of Commerce. And now we arrive, as we do at the end of each of our shows, at the Asia Insider Minute, where I give my own take on the topic at hand. As of this moment, no one knows what to make of the Trump-Kim detente. Maybe the cynics are wrong. Perhaps this is the beginning of the opening of North Korea. Still, the unmaking of a dictator is no easy task. Erasing decades of authoritarian and human rights violations won't be expunged with a slap on the back and a selfie. But maybe this is the means, however surrealistic, of prying North Korea from a half century of isolationism. Maybe a simple handshake was all Kim needed to show the world that change is possible. The bigger question, however, is political. If recent events do set into motion a sustained period of military de-escalation and economic liberalization, to what degree should Donald Trump be credited? Has this deal guy turned president just proved to the world that gut instinct is a better determinant of new opportunity than diplomacy or sanctions? Or are there other forces in motion? I have a theory, and maybe it's crazy, but here goes. Trump has been pushing China and Xi Jinping to step up and exert pressure on North Korea. For years, China has paid lip service to the West, agreeing in principle to talk North Korea down, but with little evidence to show for it. What if, during this time of America First posturing, Xi sidled up to Kim with a bright idea? What if these two North Asian leaders, pragmatists that they are, agreed that appearances likely will mean more to this U.S. president than any U.S. president before him? Smile, shake, nod, and feign agreement in order to be assured of two things. First, that Donald Trump will, at least for a period of time, feel appeased. And second, to allow Trump to take this seeming victory back home, shore up his political base, and raise prospects for winning a second term. Think about it. North Korea acts the supplicant. China benefits from reduced U.S. attention on Asia. Trump gets reelected and the U.S. continues its withdrawal as a global leader to focus on domestic woes. It's the penultimate Juno move, where the weaker player uses balance, leverage, and the weight of his opponent to turn the tables and emerge victorious. It comes down to this. If you have a guy in the White House who thinks he can unwind dictatorships with a handshake and a pat on the back, that's the kind of guy North Korea and China won in the ring, and for the long run. Sound crazy? You decide. This sideshow still has game, so stay tuned. Until next week, I'm Steve Stein saying, come in from the outside on Inside Asia.